Okay, I think we can start now.
The chant.
Starting.
Full chant now.
Ahaṃ Sammā Sambuddho Bhagavā Buddhaṃ Bhagavantaṃ Abhivādhemi Sukhato Bhagavata Dhammo Sūpatipanno Bhagavato Savakasangho Sanghaṃ Namāmi Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammā Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammā Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammā Sambuddhassa Buddhaṃ Saraṇaṃ Gacchāmi Dhammaṃ Saraṇaṃ Gacchāmi Sanghaṃ Saraṇaṃ Gacchāmi Tuthiyampi Buddhaṃ Saraṇaṃ Gacchāmi Tuthiyampi Dhammaṃ Saraṇaṃ Gacchāmi Tuthiyampi Sanghaṃ Saraṇaṃ Gacchāmi Tathiyampi Buddhaṃ Saraṇaṃ Gacchāmi Tathiyampi Dhammaṃ Saraṇaṃ Gacchāmi Tathiyampi Sanghaṃ Saraṇaṃ Gacchāmi Iti hi so Bhagavā Arahaṃ Sammā Sambuddho Vijja Saraṇa Sampanno Sukhato Lokavidu Anuttaro Purisadhamma Sati Sasa Deva Manusana Buddho Bhagavati Suvakaso Bhagavata Dhammo Sandhitiko Athariko Ehi Pasiko O Ashatam Vedisako Vinyuhiki Supatipanno Bhagavato Savakasangho Ujjupatipanno Bhagavato Savakasangho Yāya Patipanno Bhagavato Savakasangho Samīci Patipanno Bhagavato Savakasangho Yādhīdāṃ chathāri purisāyukāni Hatha Purisa Puga Esa Bhagavato Savakasangho Aruneyo Aruneyo กิเนโยอัญชลิขานิโยอนุชารังปุญญะเทสังโลกัสสาติ
Again, you need to do the other three sets once. So now we do the method chant in English and the mat.
This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, or missing none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a father's heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and upwards to the depths, upwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain its recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
So now we do the questions which people put in the basket. See what we have for you this evening. So it's quite a few, so I'll try and do them pretty quickly, unless there's something really interesting comes up with the questions, then I'll go into detail. What is the difference between samadhi and nimitta? The word samadhi means stillness. So that's what samadhi is, stillness. The more still you are, the more there is samadhi. A certain state of stillness, the nimitta, this light in the mind, arises. So you might say that it always comes at a certain level of stillness, in particular when the five senses are so calmed down, they're so still, that the sixth sense, the mind, becomes stronger. So you can imagine, I use my two hands here. These are the five senses. They're usually so loud, so strong, that they swamp the mind. You can't even know the mind much. But when the five senses, they calm down, they calm down, they calm down, they calm down, then the mind becomes manifest. That's where you see the nimitta. Now, sometimes people with very pure minds, very good minds, the mind is so strong that it comes up before the five senses disappear. It's a very strong mind, and with parts of meditation, those who really get into it and really get lots of very deep meditation, the nimitta is so strong that it usually stays with you maybe all day. You're eating the lunch and it's like eating the lunch through a blind light. The mind is just so stronger than the five senses. That's only when you do a lot of meditation. So that's actually what this nimitta is. It's a sign the mind and the body become very still. Can you teach us how to develop mindfulness and kindness to move to delightful breathing? Thanks. Well, I've already done that, so I'll do it again. It's actually, when you're watching the breath, when it gets very still and peaceful, it is the nature of whatever you look at, whatever you hear, whatever you taste, whatever you smell even, when you get very still, it becomes beautiful, it becomes delightful. Everything you do becomes delightful. The sounds are just more intense and more delightful, the food is more delicious. Now everything becomes delightful simply because you've got more mental energy. And that's one of the reasons why, I keep on saying, one of the causes for grumpiness and anger and guilt and all the negativity in our modern world is because we run dry of mental energy. We're running on low, almost empty, which means we've got no resilience at all. But as you do less, as you empower your mind, it gets brighter, you see more, you feel more, you've got more happiness, which means you don't tend to get grumpy or angry. You've got more resilience. People can call you all sorts of things. Ah, okay, I'm happy. Just like when somebody wins a lottery. If you win the lottery and somebody cuts into you on the road, hey, you don't mind, I even cut into me, I just won 10 euro off a lottery. Who cares? When you're really, really happy, basically you can't get upset. But if you've been really miserable, had a really terrible day at work, and somebody just cuts into you, that stupid idiot, they should know better than that. Please excuse me, I'm not playing, I'm not trying to get angry, because I'm not allowed to get angry unless I'm telling a story. So it's really interesting, I'm not playing on this. So anyway, that's what happens when you really get peaceful. You get energy, and the breath appears delightful. But when that happens, unfortunately some people think, oh, that can't be right, I'm enjoying myself. That is right in meditation. The breath is supposed to become delightful. And everything you experience is supposed to be happy. In Pali it's called the cultivation of pity and sutta. In the Anapanasati Sutta, it is stage number 5 and 6 of the 16 stages of Anapanasati. So I mention that just again to ground this in the Buddha's teachings, so nobody thinks I'm making it up myself. Feel your emptiness. While I was meditating this afternoon, I felt my hands were contorted in some weird position, even though I didn't move them there at all. Also, I felt that I couldn't feel my hands at all after a while. Is that normal during meditation? Yes, very normal. By the way, how do we swallow saliva during meditation without disrupting the stillness? Thank you. Okay, the thing is just to swallow it. You disturb it a little bit, but if you don't swallow saliva, the thought is, when can I swallow this? When should I swallow this? It keeps on coming up again and again and again, and that disturbs you. So just get it over and done with, just swallow it and finish with it. And then it doesn't disturb you very much. Yeah, sometimes you may have to swallow 2 or 3 times, but then the feeling disappears. So it's usually best to swallow as soon as possible. But as for your hands contorted into some weird position, this is part of the meditation where your body starts to move and contort and do it all by itself. That is always a very good sign. And I say this because the standard story
The first time I saw this when I was teaching a long time ago in Perth, I opened my eyes and some woman was incredibly contorted. Her whole body was twisted. And I was actually quite concerned, you know, as a teacher, that my goodness, when she comes out of meditation, she's going to be really sore. I mean, she really was, you know, like twisted. I can't do that. It was just weird. And so afterwards, I took her aside and said, "Are you okay?" She said, "Oh, fine." I said, "You know how you're sitting?" And I tried to imitate it. I said, "This is like this, only, you know, twice as much." But really, was I? But yeah, you were. And then I think something clicked in her. She said, "Oh, yeah, I had this accident some time ago. I feel really, really good now." And I soon figured out what was happening when you get out of the way, when you're not controlling your body. The body twists around so it can open up energies, which, you know, usually you get those channels to be opened up anyway because of some accident and injury. And you can't open it up. So the body twists around because it knows that's what it needs. So if you do contort, great. Your body is putting itself in a position so it can heal. So you just let it do that. When it happens, you know afterwards you're going to feel really great. An ache or a pain somewhere, an old injury is going to get healed, or at least go a long way towards healing. So any contortion of the body, it's totally unintentional, you didn't order it at all, it's automatic, great. It's the body knowing what it needs to do. So I think people do that, they twist around, they bend around. It's just what you need to do is to open up those channels of energy for healing. The body is very smart, it knows how to heal itself, all you need to do is get out of the way. That's where you do meditation. And when your hands actually start to disappear, either this is actually very common, you maybe have a contortion first of all in the beginning, so they go enough to be able to allow the body to do its own thing, and then soon afterwards the whole thing disappears. So you can't feel anything. That's standard, and that's very good. Whoever did that, you're getting someone. Now your hands have disappeared, see how much else you can get to disappear. Your legs, your body, especially your head. I don't know about you, there must be some. I do still suffer from a bit of allergies and hay fever, and my nose is a bit stuffed up. And sometimes, because of that, I've got a little, slightly irritating cough every now and again. That's wonderful when my head disappears, I don't have to worry about it anymore. Really a pain having your head. Is it true you acquired powers of clairvoyance and able to see auras with great meditation? Yeah, you can do things like that. Just part of the course, but you don't tell people. If any of you get any powers, especially of being able to read people's minds, number one, don't tell them. Otherwise they'll be so scared of you. And number two, it's an invasion of personal privacy to read another person's mind without their consent. You just don't do it. Good monks, good nuns, anyone who's got deep meditation will never do that. And number three, now, be honest with yourself, your mind. Who would want to read your mind? people who do this are wise enough to say, "Oh, shit, that's rubbish, I'm not going to read that." So you're pretty safe. So sometimes these things happen, it's just part of the course. But you don't emphasize that. Because that's one of the things which the Buddha said. He said, all those psychic powers, yes, they happen. But they're pretty dangerous simply because that if you can start to read minds, imagine that I claim to read minds and it was proven, then people from the CIA or ACO is in Australia or MI5, because I've still got a British passport, they'll get hold of me and they make me interrogate all the prisoners. It's far more efficient. Actually, I'll just read this guy's mind. Is he a terrorist? Oh yeah, yeah. And what all the information, yeah, this is all the information. This is where all the Taliban live, and this is what the clan is doing. They'll never leave me alone. So sometimes you can imagine. Imagine that you had the gift of levitation. What would happen if you could levitate? Straight away Australia, who's not really sending a very strong athletics team to the London Olympics this year, they'll get me to go there. So the high jump, the pole vault, don't get me to do that, so I get the gold medal because I can meditate. I don't need the pole, I can stand there and over. So there'll be a lot of problems, if you're so told people about that. you become a circus freak. And then all these scientists would insist on doing experiments on you. You'd be just, first of all, you'd be a circus freak, then you'd be a laboratory rat. So that's why I'm keeping things quiet. Next, dear Ajahn, no swimming is stated as one of the rules for the eight precepts retreat. Earth is one of the few things that relieves my shoulders, the neck and back pains for walking and sitting. Is it okay for an occasional soak in the pool for physical health with metta, pain and neck? Yes, it certainly is. So it's okay to swim for health. But when it's simply swimming, just mucking about in the pool, just for play, splashing this and splashing that, if it's just for recreation, then it's a no. If it's for exercise, yes. So, you know, if you have got a bad back and you want to soak in the bath, fine. Or in the spa, fine. Just for your health and comfort, then do that. Or if you really feel you need to do a couple of laps of the pool or something, fine. But as long as it's for, you know, your health and not for fun and games. Dear Ajahn Pai, my Qigong teacher says practicing this energy exercise and meditation, you can get into Samadhi and be awakened. Please comment. Thank you. Now, I don't do Qigong, so I don't know too much about it. I've seen other monks doing it. It gives you lots of energy, and so it's very, very good. But it's important to get into stillness, Samadhi, that your body disappears. So there has to be some time when you're so still, you don't move at all. So all the awareness of the body and seeing and hearing all disappear, so you can get these images and get into the jhanas. And only then can you be awakened. In other words, you get such strong mindfulness you can actually see what's going on. I'll give some more examples of insight later on during the retreat. Buddha said that people who meditated made merit. When does merit happen in meditation? I think merit happens when people can be still and mindful. I think frustrated meditation does not make merit. Is it correct? Yeah, the Buddha said this because he was understanding this word merit in Pali Punya, in Thai Bun, that this merit, it is actually like spiritual qualities accumulating from your wisdom, your insight, and your ability basically to let go and be free, and be peaceful. The more you can be peaceful and free and let go, the more merit you have and the more merit you're making. Which is why that when you really let go and be peaceful, so you get into these deep meditations, that is karmically incredibly powerful. Which means you've made a whole heap of good karma. And that's actually what the Buddha said, which is amazing teaching when you first see it. Now you can say, you know, give thousands of dollars, save billions of dollars. Now even to like the sound of the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, as I was saying yesterday. That's a huge amount of merit. But it's nowhere near as good merit as just keeping the five precepts for one day. Just keeping precepts is far more merit than any donation. Why? It is because you can give donations, and for some people that's very easy. And some very, very wealthy people that don't even notice it. But keeping precepts is hard. You have to restrain, you know, all of the wants. You know, I want to have sex with someone else. I hate mosquitoes. You know, I want to have just a glass of alcohol. Just a glass, please, that's all. I mean, that takes a lot of restraint, keeping precepts, not telling lies. That's why it's harder to do. And it's more pure, it's greater merit. And even greater than keeping precepts is meditating. Because many people can keep those precepts, but they find it hard to keep the mind still. And you all know that because you've spent the last few days or the last 24 hours meditating. And if you get the skill of keeping the mind still, that's very, very powerful. And that's one of the highest merits, to have the release of the mind in meditation. It's a huge merit. Because you're getting closer and closer and closer to Nirvana. You're getting really close when you get into jhanas. So that's why it's huge merit. So what you're doing here is immense. But please, it doesn't mean if I meditate, that means I don't have to give any more donations. Unless it doesn't work that way, because the more you meditate, the more you want to be generous, the more you want to keep your precepts. That's certainly was my experience, just being a Westerner, not really knowing about karma and precepts and stuff. I meditated first. When I meditated, my mind got peaceful, it had enough natural insight, and I didn't really feel like sort of breaking out those precepts anymore. I discovered the precepts myself. It didn't make any sense to take alcohol anymore. I couldn't see the point in it. Lying, you felt really bad. If you're sensitive enough for meditation, you feel really, really bad if you lie to someone. And obviously, committing adultery, for me that was cheating on my girlfriend. You couldn't do that, it would hurt her. It made no sense to me at all. And when you meditate, you get very sensitive to your own feelings and the feelings of others. And stealing or killing, you just couldn't do that. And so I just started keeping the five precepts and I became a vegetarian, just quite naturally. I remember the time I was visiting the Thai temple, which was in East Street at the time. And one day I'd be going there long enough, and the monk said to me, he said, "You've been coming here long enough, it's about time you took your five precepts." So I remember that conversation very well. I said, "Venerable sir, what are the five precepts?" He said, "Not intentionally killing a living being, not stealing, not committing adultery, not lying, and not taking alcohol on non-medicinal grounds." You know what I said? I said, "Venerable sir, I would be keeping them. I don't need to take them from you. I would have been keeping them for quite a few months now." He said, "Okay, fair enough." That's not what he said, fair enough. There's something else entirely coming out of that. But I discovered those myself, in a natural way of living. So you can see that when you meditate, you get the insights of precepts, they come along as almost like a free gift in the cornflakes box. So you don't buy it, but it's just a free gift which comes along, same with generosity. You just love being generous. And it's really nice when people just do generosity, it's sort of fun thing. "Yeah, no, I want to donate your meal today." No, it's my turn. No, I'll donate it. That's why I was just cleaning up my room today. And I got all this food which you've been offering me for the last week. There's no way I can eat all of that. I get enough at sort of the lunch and the breakfast. But nevertheless, I always accept what you give me, simply because it's wonderful to be kind, to give. Imagine if I said, "You gave me some," I said, "No, I don't need it. Take it away." That's terrible, isn't it? It's also one of the reasons I'm fat. If you keep giving me all this food, and I just can't refuse it. Even some of the food, quite a few, sometimes I don't like it, but I still put it in my mouth. For fun. Anyway, last year's retreat in Phuket, last year's retreat in Phuket has benefited me, a beginner of meditation, and experienced a calm and peace at heart during the retreat. Thank you. Back home after that, I realized that the usual frustrations and demands of work seem to have gotten a stronger hold of me, and I felt really drained. Is this the result of a more aware mind and hypersensitivity? What should I do if I feel the same thing after this retreat? It probably is a sign of increased sensitivity. Now that you've had a taste of peace and a taste of freedom when you go back to jail after being on parole for a week, you really realise, "Oh, this jail really hurts." I think it's more like the sensitivity, the frustration, the tiredness was probably there before, but you never really noticed it, you got used to it. So what I ask you to do when you go back this time is please take some of this meditation and do it during the middle of your work day. 5 or 10 minutes. Which means you don't get so drained at work. Now don't tell me, "Oh, I can't spare 10 minutes, you don't know what my office is like, it's hectic." If it's hectic, that's why you should take 10 minutes out to meditate. Because the 10 minutes you spend meditating, not doing any work, is an investment for what happens afterwards. You'll find in the next 2 or 3 hours you get 4 hours work done, of high quality. It's using your brain efficiently. in business, in work, we are so inefficient and stupid the way we use our breath. When it gets tired, we keep pushing on, which means our output goes down, and we keep making too many mistakes when we're tired. That is not the way to run a business. If you could only allow yourself 10 or 15 minutes of quiet time, when you go back to your workstation afterwards, you're clear, you're rested, empowered, you can get more work done, you can type up that report far quicker, the words come to your mind easier, and you have a higher quality output. You know that, when you're tired, what's your efficiency like? How many mistakes do you make when you're tired? When you're rested and clear, things flow so smoothly, you get the letters written really quickly, and they're really to the point, they're accurate, because your mind is working efficiently. When you know that, I've only just pointed out about the benefits for your business. More work done, higher quality. As far as you're concerned, it means you don't get so stressed out and so drained. And take those little breaks. And if your boss doesn't understand, see, even the electricity has to take a break every now and then so it doesn't get stressed out. So if your boss doesn't understand, you have these beautiful places in every office. One of the only places you can meditate quietly called the toilet. You can always, okay. So you can always use the toilet because that's nice and quiet and peaceful. Okay, so the next question is... okay, the lights will come on afterwards. Here they go. So that's actually what you should try and do so that you don't get so drained from working while after this retreat. Get a 5 or 10 minute break. Go to the toilet. Sit on the toilet seat. If you like, take your cushion with you. Maybe that's a bit of a giveaway. Sit down there and just meditate for a few seconds. Few minutes. Venerable Sir, are we wrong to search for knowledge about Buddhist doctrines? A short while ago I came across the word Gandhava, which sent me to search for the mechanism of death and rebirth. A friend of mine chided me for being a wanderer. I also came across a sutta, the Majjhima Nikaya 25, the Dhyabha and the Wampa, in which the Buddha said we should not be asking questions like the soul is one thing and the body is another. Please guide me, am I wrong to ask questions and search for answers within the bound of Theravada tradition? 2600 years after the Buddha, mankind now knows about more about the universe and quantum physics. So what were incomprehensible may now be comprehensible. The Buddha might agree to explain some of the ideas that he did not want to talk about. It's okay if you want to do study, and it's actually a great thing to do if that is your you like studying and it interests you and you've got a good brain, that's wonderful. Get into those sutras. I'm even encouraging people, you know, if you're sort of young and your brain is still in good working order, even to learn Pali. Now anyone who's done Latin at school, you know, Pali is so similar, it's not that hard to learn. And then when you read these Buddhist teachings, you can read it in the original language. And I did that. There was one monk who came and told me, I was in Thailand all this time, and we didn't do much study at all. But he went to Sri Lanka, and he said that the monks in Sri Lanka laughed at him, they ridiculed him, when he said he didn't understand any Pali, because it is just every Sri Lankan monk has to understand Pali, at least some Pali. And so he said he was forced to learn Pali. And I thought, I'm still got a good brain. So I decided to learn Pali. It was very easy to do. And then I started teaching other people to learn Pali. And the reason I encouraged it, because when I started reading these things in the original language,
with some of the translations, you know, like concentration for samadhi, that wasn't the meaning. It's very clear when you read the language in its original what these words actually mean. And that just opened up so much of the Dharma to me. Or this thing about samatha, vipassana, you read that, you don't read the two types of meditation, samatha meditation or vipassana meditation. That's hardly ever there at all. It is there in one or two places, but the Buddha kept on saying, no, eightfold path, jhanas and jhanas and jhanas. And that really made an impression on me, when you read it in actual Pali. So it's good to be able to do that, if that is, you know, your ability and your inclination. If you're one of these people who've had it with study, either you've got it, you know, past it, you know, the neurons in your brain have already worn out, it's enough just to remember what you're supposed to do today, where you put your shoes. So if that's you, then just forget about it. It's not essential, it's just an interesting extra thing you can do. And, you know, where it says in this particular sutta about asking questions like the soul is one thing and the body is another, you may understand from those questions it's actually assuming that there is such a thing as a soul. So the Buddha is actually saying the questions are wrongly formulated. Now, like, there's a question which was very common in spiritual search coming from the Hindu monk Ramana Maharshi, and he would always use the contemplation, who am I, who am I, who am I? Now, if you actually read in this sutra, it says that's one of the questions not to ask. Why? Because it assumes you ask something, it's just trying to find out what that is. And it neglects another answer, another third way, which is that there is nothing there. So it's not who am I is the best question, it's what do I take myself to be? What do you assume yourself to be? That's a much better line of inquiry. Now, who am I is like saying, you know, who killed Sir Julius Caesar? Maybe he suicided, he killed himself, or maybe he just died of natural causes. When you say who killed him, you're assuming that there is some person who did it. So who am I makes an assumption which isn't valid. That's a wrong question. So that's actually why the equipment seems in there. Okay, so that's it's a nice thing to debate with people who know what they're talking about. Dear emptiness, is it right to meditate with a mantra to help you watch your breath, e.g. breathe in happiness, breathe out peace? Would this not create cravings of happiness and peace, thus leading to suffering? Thank you for your advice. Now, when actually you use mantras like breathe in peace or breathe in happiness or breathe out letting go, what you're actually doing, happiness, peace, letting go, is the opposite of craving. So by saying peace, by saying let go, by saying may all beings be happy and well, I open the door of my heart to every being, that is the opposite of craving. So you're actually diminishing craving. You can't let things be and crave at the same time. Letting go and wanting are two different things. So by telling yourself peace, let go, sort of, what's the other one? Yeah, breathing in happiness. You are actually doing the letting go. So you can do that. If you breathe in, may I breathe in limiters, may I breathe out sort of all my stupidity. Now, if you actually want something, may I breathe in sort of the lottery number, may I breathe in sort of whatever else is actually part of material things, you'll find that that does disturb you. So that mantra is fine. And for those of you who want another skillful means, I was telling a couple of people this during the interviews. One of the biggest problems for people when they meditate is they can't stop thinking. Later on in life, in meditative life, you can understand how to overcome that thinking. But if you're a person who thinks, this is one skillful means to stop that, using a mantra.
Now you can make up your own mantra or you can use well-known ones. So the mantra which I've been teaching people to develop is perhaps the most famous of Buddhist mantras. It's nothing to do with Theravada, it's the Tibetan one, Om Mani Padme Hum. I only say that because most Westerners know that, so they don't have to learn it. It's already right in there. And so I tell them, but this is actually how you use it to stop the thinking. Now you close your eyes, you get your body in a good position, then you start chanting to yourself, Om Mani Padme Hum. Don't do it with your voice box, you do it with your mind, so no one else can hear it. Om Mani Padme Hum. Because you're chanting, you can't be thinking at the same time. And once you've chanted it for maybe a minute or two, then you start to introduce spaces between the words. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om. Because in those spaces, you're silent. And as you keep the chanting going, you expand the spaces longer and longer. Om Mani Padme Hum. But if you expand this too wide, so thoughts come in, then close them up again. You have to go back to Om Mani Padme Hum. So that way you extend the spaces between these words. But if the thoughts come in, you close them up again. So basically the thoughts can't find a way into your mind. And as you do this more and more, the spaces between the words get longer and longer. And so you don't need the words anymore, you've got a silent mind. Om. You don't even need that, the mind is now quiet. So that's a good way of overcoming the thinking mind. Or any obsessive music in your head or any obsessive thought, it blocks it out by putting in something else, the Om Mani Padme Hum. Stretches out the mantra by putting spaces between the words, increasing those spaces until you don't need the words anymore. A very wonderful, gentle way, gradual way, sorry, of getting into silence. Ajahn, when you have letters, when you have talks, can we talk less and meditate more? I find myself hearing your voice when I meditate afterwards. If you want more meditation and less talks, you have to ask less questions. So it is good at this time of night to actually have a bit of questions, because remember, you've had all afternoon. Question: how do we start the meditation? Be deeply, what do we focus on to start the mindfulness with? Okay, what you do at the start with is focus on your body. Because if your body is not comfortable on the seat or on the cushion, you'll find it will disturb the meditation immensely. So you start by focusing on the body. And be mindful of it, be kind to it, to get it in the best possible position. And then you take that same mindfulness and kindness which you use to relax the body, and then you turn it onto your mental world. To relax the mental world, to be mindful and to be kind to the contents of your mental world. That's the best way. Well, this is a deep question. But I can answer this one. Where am I now? Is already in my... Wow, that's deep. Yeah. It's a black sheet of paper. Dear Ajahn, I feel depressed and suicidal. Very good. I don't feel I have friends who care about me. I quite think, Molly, please help. Okay, but sometimes that you should read that book, Open the Door of Your Heart, and the first story, and that first story is about the two bad bricks in the wall. And many of you know that story. If you don't know that story, please buy that book, and just for the first story alone. Because the two bad bricks in the wall is when I made mistakes creating my first wall. I got depressed and fed up. because everybody could see that wall and they could see my mistakes. I really made a mess. And I volunteered to take visitors around that monastery so I could guide them somewhere else so no one would see my mistakes. Every time I passed that wall, my eyes went to my faults and I felt really fed up, depressed. I even had nightmares over those two mistakes. And they were so bad that I asked the monk who was with me at the time, it was Ajahn Chakra, can we buy some dynamite so I can blow it up and start again? Or can we get a bulldozer and push it over so I can redo everything? He said, no, we can't. Couldn't afford it. So for 3 months I was stuck with my mistakes, which everybody could see, and I felt terrible about. And it took 3 months until somebody saw that wall. I was with them, they said, that's a beautiful wall. And I couldn't believe what they said. It's not a beautiful wall. It's ugly. It's terrible. Look at those two bad bricks. Are you blind? And they said, yes, I can see those two bad bricks, but I can also see the 998 good bricks as well. And that was such an eye-opener for me, because I realized for 3 months all I ever saw in that wall were my two mistakes. When I thought of that wall, that's all I thought of, the mistake. In fact, that was why I wanted to destroy the world, destroy the wall, because I thought two mistakes spoiled everything. All I needed to do was to open my eyes and see the other bricks other than my mistakes. Whoever wrote this question, when you feel depressed and suicidal, the depression is just seeing the two bad bricks in your life. You need someone else to point out the 998 good bricks in your life, the wonderful life you're leading, the happiness and the joy. If you only see the faults, that's why you want to blow up the wall. That's called suicide. If you can see the beautiful things in the wall, if you do, you don't want to do that anymore. You don't have to. You can actually value yourself. And if you think you don't have friends who care about you, everyone here in this room cares about you. And so many people, even people you don't know, care about you. It's a wonderful thing to know. Once you realize that and you care about yourself, you see yourself as a beautiful person. Yeah, you got two bad bricks. We've all got our bad bricks. I tell stupid jokes. I tell the same stories over and over and over again. But that's my bad bricks. But I also tell some good stories every now and again. That's my good part. So you accept yourself as you are. And then you find you have confidence and you attract lots and lots of friends. So if you haven't got any friends and you get lonely, please talk to me and give me some advice, because I've got too many friends. I can't get rid of them. Well, whatever. Look at that 998 good bits in the water, the two bad bits. And you understand this, it just doesn't make any sense being depressed. Certainly not suicidal. Who wants to destroy a beautiful wall? And that's the person who wrote that. Dear Ajahn Brahm, does online meditation have an advantage? The only thing which it teaches you to do is learn how to sleep while you're sitting meditation. Basically, it doesn't have many advantages. We used to do that in Thailand for so many years, and I was one of those monks who actually did it very strictly. And I'm not just saying this for me, but many times I was the only one left in the hall. All the other monks, they were back in their rooms, fast asleep. But I don't know, I had this self-discipline. If it's supposed to be done, I would do it. But it's only very rarely you go into deep meditation, sitting all night. But actually afterwards you were tired for the next 2 or 3 days. It was very unnatural. And after being there and doing it for 8 or 9 years, I realized that is not really a help. So as soon as I could, I stopped doing that. And so I said, please don't do that. If you want to sit all night, fine. If you've got the meditation, if it's natural, you really want to stay up, fine, do it. But don't just go thinking, yeah, the longer I sit, the more likely it is to be enlightened. Ajahn Chah calls such meditation, where you think the longer you sit, the closer you are to enlightenment, chicken meditation.
That's what he called it. Because he said chickens sit for hours on their eggs. And they don't get enlightened, so we're not going to get enlightened either. There's the quality of your meditation. And sometimes that happens. Sometimes you're meditating, it's really peaceful, having a wonderful time, carry on. Don't just sit all night, fine. Because you want to, because it's natural. But don't force it.
Yeah.
I think because I asked that question myself, and then I realized, and I think the Thai people here, your Thai, you may understand this, that he was teaching in the northeast of Thailand. And many of the people who became monks in that area were the lazy northeasterners. So if he didn't do that, they'd be sleeping all day. I know those northeasterners because, yeah, when it was time to work, they could work. The rest of the time, they were just under their huts, under their houses, sleeping most of the day. And when you asked them, so what are you doing? They'd always say, used to serve, which means just living, that's all. They're actually doing nothing. It's just a very laid-back society, the northeasterners. That's why in central Thailand, you always think they're the dummies, the hicks, you know, the cocky bumpkins. And because they were basically lazy, that's why Ajahn Chah really made them sort of sit up all night and work hard. Because if he wasn't on their backs, they would just sleep all day. When it came to Westerners, we were just highly motivated. He didn't need to tell us to meditate. You know, we would do, because to get to Northeast Thailand and to endure the physical hardship, you know, we had motivation. Otherwise, we wouldn't have got there. Dear Venerable, I cannot grasp or wrap my head around the concept between nihilism and nirvana properly, and I've since practiced my Buddhist ways, ignoring the unsolved question. It often holds my thoughts, however. Could you please enlighten me on this issue? Thank you very much. I think the best answer is actually from a wonderful passage in the Samyutta Nikaya, which later became the basis of Nagarjuna's Majjhimaka philosophy. And it was where the Buddha said, you can't say there's nothing at all, because an arising is seen. You can't say there's something, because a passing away is seen. So I will teach you the middle way, which is this process of cause and effect. What is actually saying? You can't say there's nothing here, because you can listen to my words, you can feel you exist. There is something which arises, but it passes away immediately. So you can't say there's something persisting. This is rising and passing away of things. The cause and effect, what I call the process. So it's halfway between existing and nihilism. It's a third option. Say something that everything exists. Say there's nothing at all, it's just all illusion. No, there's a process happening. And you can hear it, feel it, see it, experience it every moment of your life. Arising and passing away. I like to use something like math because I was good at math. It's like the symbol of a point in mathematics. It's got no extension. So it hasn't got a length. It hasn't got an area, a point, but it's not nothing at all. It's halfway between existing and non-existing, a point. And that's very similar to what we call life. You can't say there's nothing, because this is arising, a sense of experience. You can't say there is something, because it falls away immediately and disappears. The middle way. He said that rise and fall, that cause and effect, that's dependent origination. How things get caused and fade away. So when it comes to nirvana, this whole process of causes and results, eventually that comes to an end. And that is called nirvana. The word nirvana was very easily understood. Now by every kid in India at the time, because it was the same word they used, just in common language,
when say you lit a candle and the candle was extinguished. When the candle went out, all the boys and girls, the farmers, everybody sat interested in Nirvana. So the Buddha used words in common usage to describe one of these amazing events in the spiritual life of a person. When something is extinguished, it's gone out, finished. And the example was a candle flame, or an oil flame, which is what the Buddha used. The flame in an oil lamp is real. You can see it, you can feel its heat. But it's only there because of three causes. The oil, the wick, and the heat. And if any of those causes stops, the oil is used up, the wick is all burnt out, or a wind blows away the heat, then the flame nirvanas. When the Buddha told this simile, he said, he asked the person he was talking to, once the flame goes out, once it nirvanas, where does it go? Does it go to the east, the west, the north? Does it go to the heaven of all flames? Does it go to the ground of all being of flames? Does it go to the original flame where everything came from? And the guy said, of course, that's rubbish, it just goes out, that's all. So just like this process called the human being. It lives because of causes. Once those causes are extinguished, things like craving, then it goes out, it finishes, just like a flame. So you are like a flame, as Elton John said, a candle in the wind. Elton John's not in mind.
How's it going?
Okay, we do a few more questions, then we have a sort of thing. How during my practice of emptying my mind to achieve stillness can I be sure that I am not actually spacing out? Again, this is a question several people have asked. Now, are you really spacing out? Are you just going to sleep? What's actually happening? You'll know, the best way of knowing is after you finish the meditation. If you finish the meditation and you're dull, you know, there's not much energy there, it means you're spaced out and gone to sleep. But if after the meditation you feel peaceful, you feel energetic, you're more aware, great, you can go in the correct direction. So just know what you've been doing by its results. And that's the best indicator. This morning I thought I had a great meditation session, but I can't remember the in-between. Was I asleep? There were no unusual signs of sleep. Are we meant to be fully conscious during meditation? I was supposed to be fully recall what we see. Again, that's the same question and the same answer. First of all, when you meditate, your mindfulness is not strong enough to know what happens when you're peaceful. Literally, it's like going from a lit room out into the darkness. At first, you can't see anything. But if you stand out in the darkness for maybe a minute or 2 minutes, the pupils of your eyes get bigger, allowing more light in, so you start to see shapes, silhouettes, and then you start to see objects. It takes time for your sight to sensitize itself to the more subtle light in the darkness. And that's the best simile to what happens when you start to get peaceful. Your mindfulness has to sensitize itself to the more subtle things going on in stillness. And at first you can't see anything, you think you're blanking out. But you get a repeated experience of those states, it's as if the pupils of your mind get bigger. You can see more, understand more. What you thought was black, there's got a lot of stuff going on in there. But this takes repeated experience to sensitize your mindfulness to more subtle images. I feel my body moving, and you mentioned before to some of the people here, because it's due to healing and energy flow. I feel the surge of energy flow through and my body feel lighter now. Thank you very much for your advice. During my meditation I also feel tears flowing down my left eye. Why is this so? Usually because people drink too much fluids and water, and when it fills up it has to overflow somewhere.
No, that doesn't count. It could be something to do with the tear ducts in the eyes. It could be just a natural sort of result of some irritation or some sickness. But often it might be just the sense that you're having a good time, you feel very joyful. Remember, those tears of joy which come up, that's part of the expression of piti sukha, of joy and happiness, which is supposed to come up in meditation. So even the Buddha said, yeah, this is just what happens when you meditate. You get so happy you just cry sometimes. I love telling the story of going to one of the pilgrimage I used to lead to India. I don't do that anymore because there's too many other appointments. And before we went on this pilgrimage to India, we did like an orientation session for all the pilgrims. So, you know, the organizer told them, you know, what to do, what to expect, and I said a few words about the spiritual side of the pilgrimage. And I said that, you know, some of these places have got powerful energy, and really powerful energy, and you might find yourself crying in some of these places. And there was one of the women who was going on this pilgrimage. Now, her husband was quite a devout Buddhist, but at the time she was just basically tagging along. And she was English, this old English lady, maybe 60 years of age at the time. And she thought, what do you mean, crying? These are only old ruins. But I lived in England. Now, every other place has got an old ruin somewhere, and that's all we're going to see, just old ruins. You don't cry when you go to an old castle, an old palace, or some old house of some important person. What are you talking about? And then what happened, you know, if those of you have gone on pilgrimage, those days if you get the plane straight to Gaya, and straight from Gaya to the hotel in Bodh Gaya, that's where you started off from. And so that evening, you know, just after a quick shower and something to eat, we all went to pay respects at the Mahabodhi temple in Bodh Gaya. And there she was, just seeing another ruin, and as soon as she went in, she started bawling, weeping, and she couldn't control herself. And she said that came completely out of the blue, and afterwards she came to say, ask forgiveness. And I thought, you're crazy, I said, well, you know, weeping or crying because of an old ruin, but it happened to me. I couldn't stop myself. And that was just showing that some of these places have huge energies. So if you really feel like crying, go for it. A lot of times you can't stop it, which is so nice. So actually many people cry during my retreats. And it's not out of pain. It's not because, oh no, I'm not that old joke again. It's usually out of joy and happiness. Your most compassionate emptiness. I told people this was a bit of a joke. How do you address me? I say your emptiness. Now, as you offer compassionate emptiness, or your most emptiness, or your ultimate emptiness, you can make them up as you go along. Surprisingly, I have experienced unstable flashing bluish limiters. However, when I try to, it's the same as they surprising. It's amazing to how people have low self-esteem and you think, well, maybe I'm successful in business, but spiritual life, you know, only monks and nuns can do that sort of stuff. But no, you did it. So when you say surprising, I'm not surprised. You know, you've got a really good teacher. What are you surprised about? I have experienced unstable flashing bluish limiters. However, when I try to focus instead on the sustained awareness of the breath, I find instead the limiters arise and my mind doesn't go to the breath but is drawn to the limiter like a fruit fighter flashing fly trap. This happened again even after I took a break and walked about. What should I do? I know these limiters don't lead to jhana. Yeah, of course they lead to jhanas. But they are very energizing and calming at the same time. But those limiters do lead to jhanas. But when they come up, don't say, oh, I shouldn't watch these things. Don't do anything. Just let the nature of the meditation happen. If you get pulled towards them, that's what you're supposed to do. That's what's supposed to happen. So just let go. Remember, don't control. What you're doing is, now I said to Timothy of the glass of water, you're holding the glass of water, you put it down, it's starting to become really, really, really still. You know, it's not supposed to be still. You're moving it again, leave it alone for goodness sake. So whatever the mind wants to do, let it do it.
From the similes which I developed, you know, for myself and for my other masters, so when you get to the stage of meditation nemesis, it's like you're driving the car and then you give the keys and the steering wheel to your partner. Okay, you drive from now on. That's what you do. You give the keys of your car to the mind. Okay, you carry on. You don't do anything. You become passenger. And your mind drives the car like a giant much better than you could ever do. So just let the mind do what it wants to do. So it gets attracted to the limiter, fine, off you go. But brilliant. But the limiter does lead you into jhanas. So keep on doing it, go that way. It is taking pain relief medication if you have a migraine before meditation considered the taking drugs. No. Sometimes people on insulin, they think, oh, I'm taking drugs, and so they come on a retreat and pass away. It's non-medicinal drugs, you know, the recreational drugs, you know, the heroin, the marijuana. You can have great limiters on LSD, but it's not going to get you enlightened. So don't take those sorts of stuff. So, you know, the non-medicinal drugs, you know, the Panadol or the stuff for migraine or the medication for your diseases, please carry on taking them. Otherwise you get big trouble from your doctors. So yeah, please take it. One more question that we have for the break. Thai Ajahn Brahm is something smarting, something testing, oh, my goodness.
Texting.
Is testing and SMSing. Yeah, is texting and SMSing breaking noble signs? But it's quiet, isn't it, when you text? It's so silent. Yeah, no need to sort of text or SMS unless it's really, really, really important. If you're texting Obama, fine. But if it's your best friend, no. Okay. So, now is the time we can take a toilet break. There's still some more questions to ask, but I'll try them afterwards. It's just gone past 9 o'clock, 9:10, so good time to have a toilet break. Come back, we'll do a few more questions, then half an hour meditation before I end for the night.